All right, in this show, we unbox how the world's greatest designers create packaging that builds brands, launches businesses, and today is no different. I'm bringing you Vincent Villiger, former creative director of packaging at Burberry. He's the creative mind behind Molton Brown's Fine Fragrance, Hotel Chocolat's latest redesign, and By Far's fragrance packaging. That's one of my favorite ones. We're going to get into the whole story behind that. That one's amazing. You're going to get three things in today's show. Before I tell you what they are, do me a favor, hit subscribe, leave a review. First thing you're going to get is how to approach designing packaging for a luxury brand. Number two, you're going to get Vincent's process from discovery, the conversations that you have, to sketching, to even the order in which he arranges his concepts to present them in a meeting in order to control the outcome of that meeting. You've got to be in control of everything. Nothing happens by chance. It's all up to you. He's going to show us how to do it. And then three, you're going to get to see how to problem solve your way to a big idea. So you don't just jump on the first thing that pops into mind. He kind of walks you through the whole process of how to get to the big idea and why sketching is critical to all of this. Do me a favor, stick around to the end of the show because at the end, I challenge Vincent to a sketch duel. I don't know who won, so you're going to have to comment who you think won. I hate to lose and I bet him a few beers. So watch it to the end and let me know who you think won. All right, let's get to the show.
If people don't deliver what you've designed, it's because they're idiots, or it's because they've done it wrong, or it's because you're a misunderstood genius. It's just nonsense, you know? And I think a lot of designers can suffer from that syndrome. They could, because I think it's very easy for designers to become a little bit detached from that. And I think what happened to me was at Burberry, we brought in an entire development team. I've not done any prep. I'm here for the chat.
Yeah, I'm just going to bullshit.
Let's buckled do in. This. Boom. Roll VT. How does the jingle go? Your jingle is like this heavy metal thing you've got going. It always catches me by surprise at the end. It's like, Jesus. How is this guy who changes jingle? You're a metalhead, aren't you?
I am, man. I gotta be authentic. You know, I've looked at like some soft ones. I used to have another jingle. It was still heavy metal, but there was like, I pulled the clip from Brad Pitt where he's like, "What's in the box?" You know, from movie 7. That was fun. But, no, yeah, I just cut it down to just the guitar riff and that's it, man. That's how we kick it off.
Yes. It always wakes me up when I'm just working away in the studio listening to you. And it's just, oh, there's another half hour gone.
Awesome, man. All right, dude. So kicking this thing off, we've got Vincent Villiger, spelt Villiger, in the studio today. I'm super excited to have you back on. I think we had you back in, it's been like almost 4 years. It's been 4 years now at this point since you were last on. Crazy. Been doing it this long. How's it going, man? How are you?
I'm all right. I think I'm a lot better than I was 4 years ago. I'm a lot better than we all were 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Nice to speak to you again.
I mean, since then, we've connected everywhere. We've been London, Monaco, Paris, and it's been great just to get to know you on a personal level, which is always cool.
That's right. We had snails together.
Yeah.
I've carried you upstairs in Monaco, had snails in Soho. It's the high life of a packaging designer.
That's right. You too can achieve eating snails. So
which is it, kids. If you study hard at school and you learn how to sketch properly, one day
you can get carried upstairs. Cool, man. All right. So Vincent, VV Designs, you're quickly becoming like the go-to luxury packaging designer. And I use that term luxury in the sense of retail, but let's just kind of kick off with like, what the hell is luxury?
It's something I've been thinking about a bit more lately. And I think a luxury brand, if you think of it almost like a pyramid, at the base, the foundation of it will be, you know, product quality. It has to be a good product. And that often goes with craftsmanship. Sometimes it comes with heritage, not a prerequisite. But on top of that, you need a point of view as well. Mm. You need to know why you're doing it. You need to know where you're going with it. Otherwise, you're a craftsman. And that's great, by the way. You know, that's the difference between a craftsman and a luxury brand is going to be, in my mind, is going to be that point of view. And that will translate really into a confidence. You know, once you know that you're good at what you're doing and you know why you're doing it, you're going to relax into it. You're going to have that confidence. And that's really the driving idea for me behind luxury brands. So when I design packaging for those luxury brands, that's really what's on top of my mind. And because then it translates visually into what I do. that confidence translates into quietness a lot of the time. Mm. You know, that's a key difference between if you're a luxury handbags brand or if you're having to sell canned beans in a supermarket.
Yeah.
You don't need to shout as much. That for me is what I try to instill in my designs, is that sense of quiet confidence and that reserve that says, you know, we don't need to shout. We know we're good. And that's really the underlying principle for a lot of my designs, for sure.
All right, let's take a quick second to talk about idpdirect.com. Go right to that website, download the design guides, the sustainability guides, the recyclable icon guide, which basically lists out all the different icons. It gives them to you in vectors. You can drop them right into your artwork right now, today, and go right into production. All right, back to the pod.
Let's say in North America, we've got different brands here that are maybe considered luxury in the US, but are not considered luxury in other countries. If we're looking at different price points, like you can get a purse from one of these brands for, say, $200. A $200 purse is going to have a bigger logo, right? It's going to still shout a little bit. And then if we go to the complete opposite end of that spectrum and look at a Birkin bag, there's no big brand, giant logo on there, right? It's like, if you know, right? that's luxury. And there's like this balance of quietness as the higher up you go in this chain, then there's really no point to say anything. It's just all about the quality, all about the design, and there's a quietness to that and a confidence there.
Oh, for sure. I mean, when it comes to money, the people who talk about it the most, is the people who have the least. You know, it's one of the things that you know, like a Birkin bag, you know what you've got. If you have one of these, you know what you've got. The people you want to know will know. They don't need the big logo. And, you know, that comes and goes. You know, also there's the fashion comes and goes of logos and no logos and all of these things. But certainly there's this underlying confidence. You don't need to shout. As you get to the top, you know, the people know. And it's, you know, it's the Zuckerberg t-shirt and it's all of that sort of quiet luxury.
Yeah.
Quiet luxury. And I think that stems from that sort of pyramid I was talking about. And it's the same in packaging.
That quiet luxury term came about from, oh my God, I can't remember what the show is.
Google to the rescue.
Yeah, ChatGPT. Succession.
There he is, the little man who started this big war.
Right now, I'm the real you.
Sure.
I've not seen Succession.
Oh my God, you haven't seen Succession? That's like the best show ever. Are you familiar with what it's about?
No. It's completely escaped me. I know of it, but yeah. I do this thing where if everybody bangs on about something, I'm suddenly a lot less interested.
Oh, well, I'm not banging on about it, but you got to check it out. It's super good. Super good. It's past enough time since it's been over that you can get into it and be completely on your own.
I might do that. I'm too busy listening to your podcast.
you're my only listener. It's pretty cool because that's the idea there was a family was completely wealthy, and throughout the entire show, it's not like they're wearing anything with big, huge logos or anything that's obvious and ostentatious. They're still wearing like Loro Piana and all these different brands that are not mass market. And that was kind of the people were hunting down, like, what are they wearing? Who are they wearing? And then trying to figure it out and then going out and buying this because they were trying to be a part of the show. And, you know, they're dropping $1,000 for a baseball hat. But, you know, price tag comes along with luxury as well.
How much do you pay for your shirt?
Oh, dude, I'm not luxury. this is only $800. But how about you? How much you pay for your sweatshirt?
This is Panga. This is one of my clients.
Nice. You got to support, right?
I've got to support. I did pay full price for this one. I'll say no ads. Hashtag no ads.
I think as a designer, when you're working with a brand, it's not just a job. Like you have to get ingrained in the culture. You have to, you know, I think it's important to support and buy the products and go through the process of like, you know, are you buying it online? Are you buying it in store? What does the consumer feel? What are they not feeling? What's missing? How can you communicate? And how can the packaging or the branding or the communication improve and move them in the direction of whatever it is that message that you're trying to carry is?
I mean, that's a key part of the job. I understood that really early on in my career, that ability you need to develop to get under the skin of the brand really, really quickly, especially as a freelancer, as a consultant. You're kind of in and out and you might be dealing with like half a dozen brands at the same time at any given time.
Yeah.
And And so you have to understand very quickly what is it that is making a Givenchy perfume different to an Yves Saint Laurent perfume. So this ability to quickly understand that and be able to dip in and out and deliver something that is going to feel unique to this brand, I think was a key element of success for me. Mm-hmm. You know, that understanding and that ability to get it really quickly. I was never able I never entertained being able to like recycle a design from one customer to another. Yeah. Like, you know, like it's not like I'm going to design this thing for you for brand A and then, you know, I'm going to recycle it for brand B 6 months later, because my designs are so targeted and tailored to who you are and what problem you're trying to solve, that the notion that this might fit, this solution might fit that other problem for that other brand is completely alien to me. So, but it is important to kind of understand what makes what differentiates brand A from brand B. And I think if you're able to do that as a success, as a designer, I think that's going to set you up for success for sure.
So then if we're talking about process and the way that you look at brands and consumers, and how's your design process unique to you?
I'm pretty old school. I'm older than I look. I know I look at that.
You're like 20. What are you talking about? You just got out of school.
Listen, you'll be surprised to learn. I'm actually over 28. I'm quite old school. So in terms of the design process itself, the real money is in that understanding.
Yeah.
You know, who are you? What's your problem? And that's where the kind of 25 years of coming up with solutions kicks in quite quickly. Normally, you know, within the first meeting or two, I get a good sense of where we're going to go with it from a solutions perspective. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time after that is spent communicating that thinking. Like you, I'm very old school. So I sketch.
Yeah.
I know you're a big fan of sketching, and I'm of the generation that really learned to sketch in design college. I graduated just as CGI was emerging. You know, it was becoming a thing, but there was only like two or three computers in my college, and none of us had a computer at home. Yeah. You know, it was that kind of cusp of modern computing. So it was really all about pencils and pens and, you know, chart pack markers and all of that malarkey. And so that's still very much how I operate. And I like it because it's quick, you know yourself. But the main thing about it is it's a lot harder to fall in love with a sketch. What you're left looking at is the idea. Whereas you can fall in love with the beautiful image, and you see it, you know, with, and I know you're a big AI fan, and you see it a lot on social media these days. Like, hey, I've got AI to make this for me. Why? It looks amazing. Well, yeah, it looks it's amazing render. Yeah.
But it's not a great idea.
It's a terrible idea, and it's a poor execution of a terrible idea. But you know, great. It's like sugar. You know, it's like sugar to the masses. Yeah. I'm not really interested in selling that to my clients. I'm interested in making sure that we've got the right idea. And so a sketch is my way of making sure of that. It's a sketch and it's a dialogue. So it's establishing that rapport, that relationship. Mm-hmm. So I work by myself and I have a network of freelancers who can help me with, you know, artworking and visualization when it comes to that stage in the project where that's needed and all the technical aspects. But all the ideation, the concepting and the client relationship is me. I build that rapport. And I think you're asking about process. That's probably one of the first differences between me and like a bigger agency, is that it's, you know, I work on a very personal level with my clients. I only have really space for half a dozen clients in a year because it's just me. And so I have to make it count. You know, you were talking earlier when we were talking about Pangai, that you invest in the client. You have to know that you're going to be able to work with these people. You're going to have to know that you care about the cause. My work is, if you know, you spend so much time working, and my business is me, and so I have to, you know, I have to make it good. I have to make it enjoyable, and so it matters. So that personal relationship is a key part of the process. But the design process in itself is very traditional. It's like in a conversation, figure out what the problem is, sketching to come with a solution. Then it's like a bit of a funnily spiral of refining the sketch up until the point you have a design that you're happy with. And then you build that up and you know, the sketches become more and more accurate and the idea becomes more and more refined. And then the key difference is that I stay involved in the development stages.
Yeah.
So one thing I always say is, it doesn't matter what I design, it matters what we make. Nobody cares what amazing concept lives on my Mac. You know, what matters is what people can see on the shelf. The coming up with the idea and the designing it is like step one of the process. But step two, which is the one that matters just as much, if not more, is that execution. And it would be easy for me to hand over a beautiful CAD and say, look, this is a shiny drawing of what I want you to do. Go make it. And then come back 6 months later and have a moan because you haven't made what I've designed,
right?
You know, but the reality is that that process between designing it and executing it, that development stage is a creative process in my mind. You know, you come up against obstacles, constraints, whether they're technical costs, you have to resolve them. And it's no good leaving that for other people. You know, I want to be the guy.
It's your child. It's your baby, right? You're not going to just... If finding your spec data is a wild goose chase around your office, you've got a data problem. Specrite is the only cloud-based management specification solution that every brand needs. Because if you don't spec right, you'll spec wrong. Yeah, you send your kid to school, but doesn't mean they go and live there. Like, you have to craft it and make sure that you're going in the right direction. And that's a challenge.
That's right. That's right. And the notion that if people don't deliver what you've designed, it's because they're idiots, or it's because they've done it wrong, or it's because you're a misunderstood genius. It's just nonsense, you know? And I think a lot of designers can suffer from that, from that syndrome. They could, because I think it's very easy for designers to become a little bit detached from that. And I think what happened to me was at Burberry, we brought in an entire development team. So guys who were like pack techs and these guys were on the floor below mine. So I would design something and hand it over and then they would have to go and make it. And if something wasn't working, I didn't have anywhere to hide. You know, all they had to do was come up to my floor and then just kind of get my nose in it. And so you learn that actually this is what goes on once you've sent your design off to development. And this is the sort of issues that come back. These are the sort of problems. And not only did I feel like it's important for me to understand it and I want to be at the table to help resolve it, to maintain the integrity of the design, but I actually really enjoy it. I'm the son of an industrialist. You know, my dad had a factory. And so I love making stuff. I'm really at ease on a factory floor. I love, you know, I just love a good factory tour. Do you know?
Right. Seeing people actually working and making stuff, and you're like, man, I want to do that.
Yeah. Like, whether they're printers or like making things. I went to this factory in Germany one day. It was amazing. They had like robots everywhere, and they had this machine, like one of my favorite machines ever. This was Carlton Druck factory. I don't know what they're called now because they've probably been bought about like half a dozen times since then. But they had this machine that would apply a glue strip to the board, right? So you apply like, I can't remember if it was a glue strip or a piece of tape, but it would apply it not only in one direction, it would also apply like another one at a 90 degree angle to it. So it was like a, and it would do that by sliding the cardboard onto like a conveyor belt with wheels that were spinning at different speeds. And so the piece of card would like spin like that. And it was just amazing. I love it.
Yeah, no, the technical side of it is so much fun because you're just like, I can't believe somebody created this for this one action. And that's one out of 1,000 different processes that happen in converting.
It's brilliant. I tell you what I love in those factories as well is they always tell you like how many million pounds they've paid for these machines. Always like multi-million pound machines.
Yeah.
But you look at, there's always a piece of tape somewhere or a post-it or a piece of cardboard. Like it always ends with, to make it work properly, somebody's had to tape a piece of cardboard to that bit. And it says like, do not remove on it or something like that. And you know that this multi-million pound piece of equipment really is relying on a piece of cardboard that Dave has taped on it, because otherwise it goes wrong. I don't know what it is. It's on every one of. Maybe somebody could write in the comments, why is it that Dave always has to tape a piece of corrugate cardboard to the end of the multi-million pound machine? We want to know.
That's hilarious. That's the best observation I think I've heard about a factory. Because you're right. I'm looking at videos of production on some different machines, and I'm like, wow, this is cool. It like drops it and it flips it and it does this, and then as it's going by, yeah, there's like a ruler that's taped to the side, or there's like a piece of tape or like something that just nudges something just enough.
Always. It's a mystery to me.
That's funny. That's hilarious, man. So you said something that I thought was pretty interesting. Like when you're focusing on like the sketching, it's really about the idea, right? So how do you go from the conversation with the client to identifying what the big idea needs to be? Like, what are you actually solving, right? You have that conversation, and it's not like you jump into, all right, I've talked to you, you need this. It's like you have that conversation, then you synthesize it into the obstacles or the challenges that they're trying to overcome. What happens there? How do you do that?
Oh, this is going to sound really wonky. I don't know. I think there's 25 years of doing it. There's a lot of it is muscle memory these days. I don't know. I think my brain is geared now towards problem solving. Mm. So as people talk, I'm like, well, if you did that, that would work. But I've been thinking about that lately because I've gotten to a stage where I think, well, this stuff, surely everybody knows this stuff. Surely like what I do, anybody could do what I do. And I think you forget that it's like being a great chef, right? You're like, surely any idiot can make an omelette, and they can't. And you forget that they can't. So a lot of it is, I think, is muscle memory and training your brain and in problem solving.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it. I couldn't think of a career that I would enjoy that wouldn't be creative. I feel like I just have to, you know, I just have to be creative. Anything other than that, especially as I'm getting older, I just cannot engage. Like my accountants, they're tearing their hair out because they can never get an answer out of me because I'm just not interested. Do you get that? Like as you get older, I can't engage with stuff that I'm not interested in.
1,000,000%, yeah.
It's not helpful for business, but it's helpful for coming up with ideas. It's helpful for the creative side of it. Have you read, there's this book called Blink, Malcolm Gladwell book. Have you read it?
I did. That's been a while because I was out quite a bit ago. Yeah.
It's about that. It's about how when you've done something so much that it becomes this kind of second nature, and how it's basically an exploration of gut feeling. And it's the whole book is deconstructing that whole gut feeling phenomenon. And something that you think is just instinct is because actually you've trained yourself to do it for so many years. And it's a brilliant book. I'd recommend it. I always recommend it. Link in bio.
That's right. Check, you know, subscribe, leave a review, link in bio. That's a great point, right? You do it so much that it just becomes second nature. But because it becomes second nature, you can do it quickly. Is there an expectation that you should charge less?
So hold that thought.
Yeah.
But the other thing is also I come at a project without the baggage. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the time people find themselves in a bit of a dead end. They're like, oh, we don't know how to fix that problem because these are all our parameters.
Yeah.
And it's almost back to that first conversation we had about confidence and quietness and luxury. And you're like, well, actually, maybe these don't need to be parameters. Oh, like we can't do this because this is where that copy goes. And this is where our procurement team says this needs to happen. And this, and you're like, and if you start challenging all these parameters and all these obstacles, and you realize that half of them actually aren't valid, or half of them are just there because nobody's challenged them. And so that's how you open new doors as well. So it's useful to be the guy that comes in with the naivety and without the baggage. And with the willingness to ruffle feathers if need be, or, you know, and you get results.
Yeah, that's the fun part. It's a tactic that gets results. And personally, I love doing something similar, right? Where, you know, you're talking to different, you're in a brand and you're talking to different people in different departments. And usually they're departments that don't get along, right? Creative, procurement, finance, like these, these are not friends within a brand normally, but you hear what challenges each one of them has and what these parameters are. And you can challenge those parameters and be the one that gives procurement a voice if they've got a great solution, but it's not being heard because of the just the internal dynamics of a brand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. For sure. One of my strengths is that I'm the guy in the middle.
Right.
And I speak both languages. So I speak production and I speak marketing. And I'm neutral in the middle because I'm not employed by the business, right?
Right.
And so it means I'm able to tell the marketing guys, well, I know you want this thing levitating in the air, but your production team can't reinvent gravity. But I can also tell the production guys, well, I know your supplier has said that this would not be the easiest way, but quite frankly, we're not here to make it easy. We're here to make it good. So can I take another look at it? And sometimes like on one of my projects, it was as straightforward as saying, have you tried it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were like, it was about foiling and embossing a logo over a piece of card where I had already debossed like a texture. So it was like the full card was debossed with this texture. They're like, well, you can't emboss your logo if you already have your debossed texture. And so what they wanted to do was reserve out a flat bit, you know, of the texture to fit the logo. But then you have, you know,
you've got alignment. Yeah.
And so they were like, we need like half a mil all around. So you have this ghost around the logo. I'm like, well, that looks crap. Like, nobody wants that. I said, what happens if you try it? They're like, what happens if you just feed it through it? And you just like stamp the hell out of it. Oh, well, it's probably not going to work. And I'm like, well, we're here. I was on the shop floor. We're here. The machine's there. It's running. How about we just turn the sheet around so that it goes through and the logo goes where your reserve isn't. It goes on the, on the back of the box where the, and we'll see. And then the guy fed it through and come out. And it was amazing. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's working. I was like, fancy that. You know, so sometimes you have to, that's what I meant earlier when I said you have to ruffle a few feathers. You have to have that naivety. You have to be the guy that says, should we try it before we decide that it's not working?
Yeah.
But it works both ways in fairness, you know. But I think even just that approach of trying to make things good rather than easy, that goes a long way. That makes you ask a lot of questions.
A lot of times production will say no to things because they've got experience as well. But they've also not pushed and tried some of these different things. So they're just looking at it like, it's probably not going to work. It's going to waste time. It's going to cost money. But if you're there and you've already done half the work, why not just push and find out? Because it may be a solution you figure out that's great for this project. And I'm sure you're going to run into it again in the future. So all of a sudden you can do a little bit more than you could before. You've gained a little bit more experience.
Yeah. And you know, you have... It's like in any world, you'll have some people who just want to get it done the way that they know how. And then you have the people who are up for play,
right?
You know, and these are the guys that you and I will seek out. You know, you want to work with the people who are people who are game and they're open to learning or open to just trying stuff. That's how we do things, you know, and, they're the people I like to surround myself with. And there's a bunch of them in the industry.
100%.
There's a bunch of people you want to stay clear of, and there's a bunch of people that will nurture that play and that sense of experimentation. And like you said, like a lot of the time, once you're past that initial pain threshold, everybody's quite grateful because they've learned something. And then, you know, more often than not, I've kind of been through that pain threshold with production guys, and then 6 months later you see it marketed on their brochures. Like, hey, we've developed this new process. Okay, great. I'll send you the bill later for like the technical development of your new product. One of them had it on an Easy Fares booth. I developed something with Burberry. And one of the guys, the manufacturers, had it out on their booth, marketed as a new solution before we'd even released the thing that we'd done. Yeah, I was like, guys, we've not even launched this yet and you're already marketing it. So I don't know, maybe it's fair game. I neither here nor there to me ultimately, but it's always worth pushing a little bit.
So talking about Burberry, and then we'll get back to pricing and some of these other things, but like you spent a long time at Burberry. Right? You were there for years. You built the team, you designed, redesigned multiple times. fragrance product pack across the board. Like this was a big part of your life. When someone leaves a brand or someone leaves an agency or someone leaves a team where that brand or that work is a big part of your personality, is there a low point after that? Do you still know who you are? Do you kind of lose sense of yourself as a designer for a little bit?
It's a good question. Yeah, so I was there 8 years and it was a great 8 years. The team was amazing and everything about it was awesome. And it does shape you. And I learned an awful lot there. You know, the designer that I was when I walked in to the designer, the creative I was when I left is an incredible progression. So I was super thankful for it. When you leave, you do kind of have to, you've got to hit that balance of people are really interested. It's giving you credit. It's a shortcut. It tells people this guy knows what he's doing because he wouldn't have had 8 years at Burberry doing what he's doing without being decent. So it's a useful shortcut, but you're also always mindful of not being defined by it or making sure that you have worth beyond it or that you're able to transfer those skills, that you're like, actually, can I do this outside of that bubble, that Burberry bubble? And it takes, it sticks for a few years. It took me a few years to feel like there was a different language, for instance. Mm-hmm. So you've got 8 years designing for a brand, and so you become imbued with that visual language and way of designing. Yeah, it takes a while to shake that bit off and go, well, actually, maybe I can do. And doing projects like a Pangaea project, for instance, is super useful in that respect because it's such a different brand. Yeah. And it's like making, making bright things, and it's like the anti-Burberry. So you kind of get to flex a different set of muscles, I left 8 years ago now, so it's interesting. So 2024 is the year that marks, where I've had my own business for as long as I was at Burberry for. And so I've been thinking about that recently because you're right. It's a very important period of your life, of your career anyway, but it's one chapter. But you learn so much.
Yeah.
There's something quite gratifying in thinking, okay, well, I've actually been able to sustain myself for as long as I was at Burberry. So clearly there's something there. I'm actually useful to people beyond Burberry.
People always talk about like imposter syndrome and, not feeling confident enough in your skills or who you are at times. You're like, they're going to discover me at some point. They're gonna be like, this guy, isn't quite who we thought he was.
I'm just so freaking awesome.
See, that's what I thought.
I think, if maybe I would suffer that if I wasn't the best. I don't know. You tell me. How does it feel?
I don't know. That's why I was asking you. I've never felt it either.
Do you know, the thing is, like, for instance, every time I have to present a set of concept to a new client, I feel nervous. Like 25 years I've been doing this. Yeah. But when it's a new client and I have to log on to that call and go like, here's my ideas, I feel super nervous about it. Because I think you care, and you know that just because you've done it right hundreds of times doesn't mean that this one's going to go right. There's always something that could go wrong. So I'm always super, super nervous about it. In the same way that I'm always super excited when something gets released and you see that in the world, that feeling never gets old. You release, a perfume, or you release whatever new product you're doing. It just makes me so giddy to see it out there in the world, and it's the best feeling, and you never want to lose that. I think the day you become blasé about that is the day you need to find something else to do, because that's the payoff, isn't it? That's the reward. You spend, this was like 2.5 years in the making.
That's crazy.
I know. Perfume takes a long time. This is like 18 months probably. It's quite typical. Mm-hmm. If you ask the brand guys, they're going to want to launch a perfume in 12 months.
Yeah.
If you ask the production guys, they're going to want 2 years. the reality is somewhere in between, like 18 months is about right. So it you know, they live with you for a while, these projects, and it's nice to see them out in the world.
You just showed Byfar. It's a purse company, it's a leather company. They want to launch a fragrance. The idea there is like make it something that is an add-on to the brand. So how does that idea happen, right? Because that nobody else is doing a fragrance as a brand. We've seen hand sanitizer as a little dangly thing, but yeah. Never.
Their brief was, we want something that people can interact with. Mm. That was their brief. They came to me because I designed a range of toys as a personal project. And they saw that and they were like, oh, we're looking for a toy designer because that's how we want our fragrance to feel. And I had to say to them, you realize I designed fragrances as well. And they didn't know. They came to me because of the toys. So I knew that at the heart of their project, what they really wanted was something that you could interact with. Their customer base, the whole brand ethos is around, it's vintage because it's around the 90s, which killed me a little bit when they told me that. And so it's kind of this young audience that want to really express themselves through their fashion choices. And so that sense of interaction and fun was there from the beginning. That was the brief. My thinking then was, okay, well, you're a handbag brand. You're a shoes and handbags brand. You're not a perfume brand. So I was thinking about legitimacy. Like, what is it that's going to make it credible for you to launch this? And also, like, it's hard work to develop a scent and to maintain then as a category, you know, to keep launching new fragrances, especially when you're a handbag brand.
Right.
So I thought if I gave them something that was an accessory rather than purely a perfume bottle, then they can play with that bit. And so they can have that newness, that almost seasonal newness that you have in bags or shoes or fashion onto the bottle. And then that means that it plays to their strength. So it was looking at it again from like, who's the client? They're, you know, and playing to their core skill set. The other enabler was the refillable element. So they were keen on considering sustainability, and so I put refillability on the table. It's a reasonably recent phenomenon, but the way people tend to do it, like the Armanis and the Dior's and all that, is you have a fancy 100 ml bottle you buy the first time, and then you get your 100 ml refill, which is in a very standard bottle, and then when your fancy bottle is empty, you just decant your refill into it, and that's it. So you decant 100 ml into 100 ml.
You can just buy the refill, basically.
well, and so in theory, but then the refill is designed where it doesn't have a spray, so there's obstacles built into this. Does the fact that it's refillable, what else does that afford us? What other doors does it open?
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, actually, 100 ml doesn't have to be one times 100 ml. It could also be five times 20 ml. I called my accountants and they confirmed. What that means is, you know, you buy the same 100 ml, but then you decant it in batches of 20 ml, which means that your bottle is smaller. And so it becomes portable in the same way that your handbag is. And so combining that sense of interaction with a sense of expression and fun and it being about a handbag and portable, that's how it all came together. So I designed this case and the team produced seven different fragrances, and the case comes in six different colors, and we have four different versions of this piece of hardware. So that's 168 combinations. And when you go and buy it, you pick all these three components separately. So you first pick your fragrance, then you pick your color, and then you pick the strap, and you make up your own. So it's a fun little device at point of sale as well. It creates a bit of engagement because you have to really kind of look at, ooh, what, you know, how can I build this thing to suit me? And then you leave with something that feels unique to you. So it's a good solution. It's a bit different. It's and it was fun to develop, and you need the right partners then to develop it. But I was looking through my decks because I presented a case study of this project the other day, and I saw that actually all of this I've sketched this in the first deck. Like, this is probably like option 1B. It was, you know, and so it was there pretty quickly. The time was spent then developing it and making it work. But conceptually, it was just kind of there very, very quickly.
So in that first deck, or even in just the concepting, was there ever just a perfume bottle? was there ever just a 100 ml version where you're like, all right, we can do this? Or did
there was other options because that's also part of the job, right? Is to give a range of options. And I don't want to find myself in a position where I say, well, I think this is a great idea, and the client, for whatever reason, maybe there's something I haven't thought of, and right. It means it doesn't work, and then I've got nowhere to go. So I always like to, you know, to have somewhere to go. Do I find that the way that I present a project and a set of ideas is almost as important as the ideas themselves. I'm very particular about how I present stuff because there's a psychology involved in it. There's a story you tell. There's a journey you take your client on. You know, the document that I build is like which concept I start with, which concept I end with, which concept I put in the middle. I always think about that quite carefully. I hate it. Like, you know, when I go through the slideshow, through the deck, and I have to make sure that all the type is like things are aligned because you go from one to the next.
Yeah.
If you've got a bit of text that juts like that, that's what you focus on. Whereas actually I want you to focus on, or it could be this or it could be that. And that's that transition does something to your brain. It goes like, okay. Whereas if I look at that text moves around, a lot of people don't care, would be like, you know, why do you care? And I care because it's a bit like when you're on, if you're an actor on stage and you break character, you know? So I don't know, for better or worse, I'm a stickler about how I present stuff. To me, it matters. It matters because you put in all that work coming up with the ideas, and if you sell them badly, you're wasting them. You know, you're throwing them away.
Yeah.
Whereas you want to make sure that people get it. You want to make sure that people follow your line of thinking, and you don't want any distractions. People can get distracted very easily by this is the wrong logo, or this is the wrong shade of blue. You know, like you want to eliminate all these distractions. You want people to focus on the bit that you need an answer to, which is, do you want it like this or do you want it like that?
Are you showing, so in that first meeting, are you showing black and white sketches, and then you kind of show a little bit of color? Is it still rough enough where you're not focused on the logo, or, you know, you kind of sketch it in there so that it's rough? Or are you showing a combination of sketches and renders?
The sketches are just in black and white.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, the sketches it's literally, I grab a stack of printer paper. I've got two pencils. I can't show you what I was sketching.
Yeah.
So I've got literally like A4 paper.
Yeah.
And then I've got one of those and then one of those, just like the fat ones.
Yeah.
Those fancy Japanese ones. And then that's literally all it is. I sketch with those two weights, and then I take a picture of the piece of paper with my phone, use an app called Scannable, and it just turns it into a PDF, and then that's it.
All right.
So it's super low tech.
Yeah.
It's super low tech. When I feel fancy, I'll add a bit of a, like a wash on it. I'll put it on the iPad and I'll add a bit of a watercolory wash on it just to kind of liven it up. But yeah, it's really, it's not about the image. It's about the idea.
100%, right? So if it's a rough concept, but you can walk them through what's happening there and spark the creativity in their mind, it's like, okay, they can get it. Or you can spend hours rendering out something that looks beautiful. But like we said, it's a bad idea. It doesn't matter how pretty we make it.
It's funny. I was in Selfridges the other day, and they had one of those, you know, those tablets that emulates paper. It was like a notepad that digitizes stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was some kind of tech device that you could, with a stylus you could draw on. So I did kind of something like this just to test it. I was like trying it, sketched a perfume bottle.
Yeah.
Thought nothing of it, left. And then these guys were like, I saw these guys coming and saw the sketch and like looking at me going like, who is this guy? Again, it's one of the things that you forget that not everybody can do it because it's a language, right? It's just like speaking. You went to art school?
Yeah.
Or design school or something. Did you have like this tutor that would always insist on tearing your sketch down or going over them with like a big red marker pen or something, just to make sure you weren't growing too precious about your drawings?
Right. No, I think for me the biggest thing was life drawing. That's where I really learned how to sketch, was like, you know, moving quickly, and I'd have, you know, instructor would come by and be like, you're focusing on the wrong things, like the big picture, the full body. Don't just focus on the face or the arm. Cause you know, you get like a good line and you're like, oh, I'm going to make this perfect. And it's like, all right, now step back. It's not a whole body. Like you've got a great arm, but we got to see the whole thing. So it's like moving quickly.
Live drawing. We had this one session that I still remember, and I still have the drawing where this was my weapon of choice, right? I used to like, and the tutor's like, this is killing you. Like this, because too much detail. And so I did this session where I had like, I don't know, 50 or 80 mil brush, like paintbrush, and just a load of black ink or black acrylic paint, whatever it was. And this big, great, like a nothing piece of paper. It was just so liberating. Like you couldn't get into detail. So it had to be about the overall feel of the posture and the light and shadow and the proportions. It was all about that and none of it about the detail. It was so liberating. It was amazing.
And that's what you did, like in that sketch, right? These are just big, broad strokes, but somebody looks at that and they see, all right, this is a box. This is how it works. This is where the product fits. You can kind of walk them through that conversation. That's where you're going to discover this won't work in fulfillment because of this reason, or this is a great solution, but you know, it's not going to fit on shelf, or like, you know, starting having those big conversations that then kind of narrow you down into, all right, here's where we're going.
When I was working on this, when we were developing this.
And that's the Molton Brown.
This is the Molton Brown fine fragrance collection. I did, like I said, I had those few ideas and I thought, well, that's the idea I'm going to work up. And so I did like beautiful renders. I do those Illustrator renders as well. So like 2D, just like a digital version of having your marker pen out, right? So like 2D renders. Spent ages like working up that render, beautiful. And then I had this, like one of those, but like a 25 mil high little kind of sketch, which I put on the board almost more for like layout effect than anything else, you know, just like I want some sketches in here and then I've got this beautiful render. And then the brand team were like, don't like that. But what's that in the corner? And that ended up being this, you know, it was that tiny little 25 mil sketch in the corner. So you never know what's going to pique people's interest. You know, you have to put it on the table.
Yeah, because you do a bunch of different concepts and sketches, and I'll have my three main ideas. Like I typically focus on three, something fairly obvious, but an improvement, and then something that I think works really well, and then something that's like really crazy. And then you kind of narrow them down. And then I'll have like my end slides. And after my end slide, I'll have just like all the different concepts, right? That like just the rough ones, kind of like that, just for effect or as a lifeline. Like they're like, all right, we like this, we like that. And you kind of hear some of the things that they say and you're like, okay, well, you know what? I had a concept that kind of addressed some of those things. We can take a look at it. Like here's all of these. And you kind of pick and choose like these little ones to get you over. The danger there is they may fall in love with something that's terrible that you didn't necessarily was just there for design. The Molton Brown fine fragrance, like that sketch was really simple, right? It was just a circle and like a square.
Yeah. So you saw it, didn't you? Because I had it up on as one of my slides in my case studies that I do at the moment. Yeah, it's literally a rectangle. It's the idea of a cylindrical bottle with a ball hovering on top of it. It was this basic idea that we felt was really strong. And I think it's down to it's going back to what I was talking about earlier about coming up with things that are going to be iconic and timeless. And you need that real, it's not minimalism, but it's that reduction. Reduction is very important to me. It's like, what can you boil this down to? What are the bits that you don't need? If a kid can draw it, it's probably quite good. It's the first step towards designing something that you know can stand the test of time, which is something that we think is important.
Every designer, every design blog, color house, they've all released their trends report. You know, you talk about timelessness. Is there a point where designers should be focusing on trends when they should be looking at them, and then maybe times when they shouldn't be?
No, is the short answer. I think by the time a journalist has identified a trend as a creative, you know, it should be behind you for a start. Mm. But also my focus is on solving a problem, making it sure that it's right for the brand and something that's going to have longevity and timelessness. And so trends don't really help me in that respect. I tend to use trends as a almost like a marker of when I've come up with something that maybe is too influenced by fashion, mm-hmm. by the now. And then it's a bit of a reminder to me that maybe it's not going to have the long lasting element that I'm looking for. You know, if you're doing an advert or a piece of graphic design that's going to live for 6 months and then be gone, then yes, you might want to harness that nowness. But I'm going to be working on this for 18 months and then it's going to be on shelves for years and years and years and years. And so if the whole idea relies on a jazzy typeface or, you know, pink color of the year or something like this, it's just going to mean that it's too much of a shot in the arm for the brand. Like the lifestyle change that's going to have lasting effects rather than the fad diet, you know? So yeah. It's the best way to put it. I don't care for trends, all that much. I think maybe it's also like a bit of a remnant of the Burberry days, where the time that I was there, the brand was so ahead of everything. Like they were like the first to do this and the first to do that. And so there was a real sense of being part of a brand that was a trailblazing brand rather than a following brand. I think that seeped into me a little bit, that notion of don't try and follow what other people are doing. I'm not like this crazy, edgy creative like a lot of these kind of art directors were at Burberry. Like they're amazing, super tuned in, like on the cusp of culture guys. And I'm nowhere near that cool, but I'm much more about the drone in the background. That's going to be that constant. That's what I'm interested in. Well, I'm just not cool enough for the edges. I'm a lot more about like the solution that's going to be viable for years to come. Is that shooting myself in the foot? Is that really boring or is that valuable? I don't know.
Because I think you have to kind of know where you fit in and where you're at, right? If somebody's coming to you because they want like the crazy something, you might not be the person that's going to address that. But if they come to you and they're like, we want something wild that solves this, this, and this, then you're approaching it with a problem solving.
And you know, it's not to say the solution has to be boring. You know, like these are the two that I always give as examples because they're just, I'm just so proud of them because this,
and there's longevity there, right? That by far gives you the option to change out the colors, change out the materials. That can continue to grow into its own thing. Where if it was super wild, then maybe that wild cutting edge thing would be amazing for 2024, but it gets tired after a while, right? Like there's that balance and there's a right fit for everyone, which, you know, and I wonder if your approach is because you're a product developer, because that was your education, right? You came from industrial design.
Yeah, and you're for sure. If you come up with an idea and you know that the first thing you're going to do is spend 18 months developing it and bringing it to life, that trend might be gone by then. TikTok will be on its next dance. and then you're stuck with an expensive piece of tool, that, you know. So... Yeah. Yeah, so it suits me to be a bit one step removed from all that stuff, for sure.
I'm a huge fan of the by far thing. You know, seeing you present the case study, going from conversation to concept to execution, and then not just execution, but then all the different variations of what can be done with it and how that can grow. Like that's the longevity, and that's what I think brands are looking for.
It was a great project, and same with the Molton brand. I think what those two projects have in common, and the reason I've enjoyed them so much, and the reason why they were, from a design perspective, I think of them as being so successful, is because the brands had such clarity over what they were trying to achieve. So the objectives were super clear. Mm. You know, they had no idea how to do it, but they knew what they wanted to do. And that's always my first port of call. That's always my first question. It's like, why are we doing this for? And I know that's something some of your previous guests have talked about, but for sure, if somebody can't tell you why they're doing what they're asking you to do, you have to run a mile or you have to get it out of them. Because if you're not clear on what your objectives are what you're going to be able to assess an idea against, right? So we're trying to achieve A, B, and C. If I come up with an idea and you haven't got those objectives to evaluate this idea against, does it achieve A, B, and C? You're left with, well, I like it, or I don't like it. I quite like it, but Mabel in accounts thinks maybe it should be different. And you're like, and you can't have a conversation like that. You and again, it's back to the problem solving part of my brain. It's very much like, this is what we're trying to fix, and we've done this. And there's more to it than that. Obviously, it has to, you have to have that reaction to it, that emotive attachment to it as well. It's not enough that the marketing director likes pink, therefore we're going to make it pink. You know, like, no brand in their right mind should have systems that allow that to happen. My presentation always starts with that, like a recap of the objectives. You're almost like playing back your brief to the client. And that's really useful to kind of make sure that you've got everybody on board. And that also, it's a good way for me to double check that I've understood the client right. Have I got the brief right? Has everybody on the client side got the same idea of what we're trying to do? You know, and more often than not, people are like, are we trying to do that? No, I thought we were trying to do this. And then you just sit back and enjoy the show and watch these guys internally figure out what it is we're doing.
Yeah.
Which is totally valid. It's a worthy conversation to be having before you're on like your fourth round of reworks.
Presenting is an art, right? Presenting is not just coming up with the concepts, but presenting and being able to funnel a group of people down a path. You know, this is what I heard, right? Is important because you may have misunderstood. There's an opportunity that you could have misunderstood the brief from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, at this point in a career, you shouldn't, but there's young designers that may have. So presenting it's back, this is what I understood.
It's a good thing for lesser designers than me. it's a great way to get buy-in and just to get everybody leveled up. But yeah, the way you present it is for sure is super important. So here's my typical structure. This is like top tip.
Top secret.
Top tip. So start with the objectives, recap of the objectives. And then when you launch into the concepts, first concept is give the client what they expect. So the bit that they think is the solution, the bit they have in mind when they brief you, we're going to do this. Give them that. So then they relax into it. They can see that they've got what they came for. They're happy. Yeah. Then in the middle, the one that I'm maybe less sure of, I had the idea, but maybe I'm not entirely sold on it, or maybe it's not entirely resolved, or. So that's the middle one. And then I finish with what I really want to do. The bit that's maybe a little bit, it still answers the brief, of course, but it's maybe the less expected solution, something that the client might not have thought about, the bit that excited me. And I really want to get them to do the less safe route. That's the bit I end on. And that's kind of my typical framework for presenting.
Yeah.
And that's worked all right so far.
Yeah. No, that's funny. I do something similar but different. I go obvious, and then I go more of like the wilder one, right? Like the wilder one for me that I want to push them into. And then I go into the wild one that is like pretty far out there. And I always think of it like, okay, yeah, same. Ease them in, then surprise them. And then this one's like, answers the brief, but it's a little too crazy. Cause then they go, well, let's go back to that other one. Right. Cause I always worry is like, if I want them to go back, and they might go back to the first one. Okay. We go back to the first one. We kind of walk through it again. And I was like, all right. And you kind of narrow it down. But everybody kind of does it differently. Right. That's the beauty.
The bit you should never do is show stuff that you don't want to go ahead.
That always wins.
Because this is it. This is it. You cannot rely on the fact that other people are going to hate it as much as you do.
Yeah.
And so, do you know, have I told you, I can't remember if I've told this story on our first podcast, but the whole, the St. Paul's Cathedral design story, have I told you that?
No.
Christopher Wren. So Christopher Wren was hired to redesign St. Paul's Cathedral after the Great Fire of London, I think. And he really wanted a dome. But the monks or the priest or like whoever commissioned the design of the cathedral wanted a spire, wanted a traditional spire. And so he thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do like a mix of the two. It's going to be this dome that then has a spire on top. And it's going to be so ugly. They're going to have to say no. And then we're going to go with the dome.
Yeah.
Except they loved it. And so that's what they wanted him to build. And so he was locked into this crappy design that he'd thought of. And so what he decided to do was to build a big ass scaffold around the build and just build what he wanted anyway, because he thought by the time that cathedral's finished, they'll all be dead and none of it will matter. So the moral to that story, which I think might be true, is if there's something you don't believe in or you don't want to do it, just don't put it in there, because there's every chance that it'll make it through, and then you're going to have a job on your hand trying to backpedal out of it.
Yeah. All right, man. So I'm going to wrap up here. If anybody wants to reach out to you, Vincent Villager, link in bio.
I am VV_luxurypackaging on Instagram, Vincent Villager on LinkedIn with an E, not an A. So not like a villager, but like with an E.
Like a proper villager. That is an E. Right?
No, yeah. a villager, like a person who lives in a village, is with an A.
No.
Yes.
Got wait. Yeah. I'm thinking of the second E. I'm like, wait, no, there's no.
Oh, no, the first E. So I've got two E's. VILLEGER.
That's me. Right.
That's me. Look, I can't spell.
I don't live in a village, so I can't spell.
Yeah. So that's where you find me. Get in touch.
Yeah, definitely reach out to, put any questions in the comments, reach out to Vincent, check out his website. He's got some really cool work on there. You can see all the stuff that he's done. Definitely the go-to luxury brand creator. Hey, can I challenge you to a sketch?
What are we sketching?
Let's do a rigid hinged box, with a magnetic closure, but open. Yeah.
Open.
Yeah. 3/4 view. Super fast.
Like a clamshell type thing.
The
ones with the magnetic front.
The magnetic front, and it comes up.
Oh yeah, okay.
All right. You ready?
Yeah. Oh, these are a bitch.
Three-quarter view. And go.
Do you want a vacuum insert in it?
What's that?
Do you want a vacform insert inside of it?
Yes. To hold 5 products.
It's got to have a little arrow to say this bit pivots.
Yes. All right. What do you got?
Oh, I'm not finished.
Oh. I'll add some line weight in here then while we wait.
Yeah.
But I love sketching. I get right into that zone. It's, I don't know. This is my happy place. While I'm sketching, I usually go over a line a few different times. It's not like perfect and crisp. And while I'm doing that, it's almost like meditating. Like that's where my ideas kind of show up, is like during this process, because I'm not distracted. I guess that's kind of the key, is like, what can you do to not allow yourself to be distracted, to be able to get some clarity in your concept. And I'm just using a ballpoint pen that I had on my desk.
Hang on.
Oh, you do have a nice. I love that.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, see?
Thing.